So it is March 24th, and it's after exam number two, and everybody's in a state of shock. But that's okay, because exam number three will be very much like exam number two. Many of the questions you saw in exam number two will be there in exam number three. They'll be, you know, changed around. But the same stuff. So I want you to continue studying chapter five. And when you continue studying chapter five, I want you to make sure you can do those worksheets from chapter six, especially constant perpetual and the discounted cash flow, the problems that we saw with Clorox and the one with Abbott Labs, because they will be on the next exam. And that will be a third exam. And they'll be on the fourth exam. And they'll be on the final exam. Because those are things I want you to understand. I want you to be able to do them in your sleep. In fact, I want them to be invading your sleep. And because we have done the heavy lifting. The heavy lifting for stocks we have done. And now what we're going to do, we're going to do something that's not too silly. And that's chapter 17. But then we're going to take a look at some of the silliness after we come back from the break. Because you understand, after Thursday, we have a week off, which is an excellent opportunity to forget about Business 123. No, to study chapters 5 and 6, and then 17 and 7 and 8, and we'll come back 7 and 8. They're pretty. There's not that much in them. They're very, very light. And before we do that, though, I wanted to show you. This is. I apologize because this is what I forgot to bring on last week. Oh, who's got the spreadsheet? You know, pass the spreadsheet around. This is what I forgot to bring last week when we took a look at Value Line. And here's Procter & Gamble. And we looked at the example here, but we looked at McGraw-Hill. But look what they give Procter & Gamble. Even though this is one of the time-tested stocks of all time, timeliness, 5. And it's one of the stocks we chose, and notice they're absolutely on the money. How has it done for us? Bad. It's been one of our worst performers. But at the very least, they tell us down here, where is it? Look, they say that, yes, they've been growing their dividends. Where is it? Where's the dividend growth rate? I can't see. Okay. They've been growing their dividends the past 10 years. Here it is. They've been growing their dividends the past 10 years, past 5 years, 9.5%. But look at what they're saying. In the next 2-3 years, they don't expect the dividend growth rate to be very high. So they're a little bit not so sanguine, not so happy about this. And this untimely blue chip continues to inch higher and still trades. However, earnings and cash flow comparisons have been less than stellar, so our system has pegged Procter & Gamble to unperform for the year ahead. But we still think this is a very high-quality stock for most investors. So thank you, Value Line, for affirming what we... Did I show you guys how we did? I think I did, didn't I? Maybe I didn't. Let's go back. And... Yeah, look it up. We're this morning, before you guys got here, we were at 7, and now we're at 6.5. But look, it's been our worst performer. Not quite. Yeah, that has been our worst performer. Okay, so let's go back to, now, 3M. They're giving 3M a timeliness of 3, which, again, they're not too excited. But still, would you be happy? It's at 158, and they expect it to be between whatever it is now, upwards of 190. And where's that? The dividend growth rate is pretty good. Where's that? That's down there. Did I circle that? They expect the dividends to grow at 11%. And if you read through, they say, you know, we think it's still a pretty darn good stock. And are people going to stop using scotch tape and post-it notes and all the other things that they, thousands of different stuff they create? And then GE, they're really excited about GE. Now, this is... The copy machine at the library screwed up. But if you see the recent price, $24, they think in 2 to 3 years it's going to be between $35 and $45. So would you be happy with a stock that did that well? General Electric? And they're telling people down here, you can't read it, but they're telling people, yeah, we're pretty happy about General Electric. But look at what they think of what's going to happen with Apple. You can't read it. Darn it! You can't see it. Didn't copy well. Yes. So, by the way, I didn't really copy them. You're not supposed to go to the library and copy them. Like, shh, don't tell people. But they're paying $1.88, and in 3 to 4 years, they think they're going to be paying $3 a share. That's a 19% dividend growth rate. What are they going to do with all the cash? They got, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars of cash. Not quite hundreds. Like a hundred and something billion dollars of cash. And they're, you can't see it, but they think the price, 113, they think the price is going to be between 150 and like 200 or something. And that's Apple. That means it'll be the first $1 trillion company. The first company worth $1 trillion. What do you think? Well, as long as people still line up around the block whenever they got a new product out. When's the watch coming out?
In April.
In April?
And you got to figure that eventually the watch is going to go down in price and everybody's going to buy it.
Not Apple's. Do you think Apple will? You think they'll? No, what they'll do is they'll come out with a cheap one. You know, they won't. I mean, Apple, they came out with that 5S phone, right?
Yeah.
No, wait a minute. What was the cheap one? The C?
Yeah.
And how did it do? It didn't do that well, did it? No, people who buy Apple, they want the best. You just got an Apple iPhone here. Got the 6, 6S, or whatever it's called? The 6, what's the big one? 6 Plus, of course. I'm sorry. I got a sleaze phone. Okay, we got extras back there? Okay. Got an extra? Okay. There you go. Okay, everybody got one? Okay. So what do you think? Going to buy Apple? We did. We've done pretty darn well, actually. And so, hey. But you know what scares me? If they just come out with one stinker, one thing that really pisses people off, they could just lose that untarnished. Do you think that could happen?
Yeah.
I don't know. They're pretty conservative. I mean, you think of Apple as a very unconservative, you know, unconventional company, but they, when they put out something, they want to make sure it's not, people are not going to go. And so, anyway, we'll see. We'll see. I don't own your stock, so actually, I do through mutual funds. All right. So, wow, look at that. I'm not going to get much done today. That's all right. Spring joke. Anybody want a spring joke? What do you get when you cross a rabbit with an anesthesiologist? The ether bunny. Ether bunny. Okay. So what we said is that we have done the heavy lifting for stocks. You've got to go back over, study chapter 5, do the worksheets in chapter 6. But this is actually pretty cool. What they did in the third edition... In the third edition, it was chapter 7, right after chapter 6. And what they did is they put it to the end, which means it's one of their optional chapters. In the book, the way the book does it, throws stuff at the back that they don't think you really have to go through. And they then took the emphasis off the financial statements and ratio analysis and put it into projecting cash flow and earnings, which is important, but that's what Value Line does for us. And we can learn those. But more importantly is the ratio analysis. And why do I continue to put this into our class? Because Benjamin Graham uses ratio analysis. So when you read The Intelligent Investor, don't read that the first book, don't make that your first book, you're going to see him using this. So you will go back, oh yeah, I remember Pagano did some of that. And it is. It's important. It's part of the stew. It's part of the thing we need to do. I put more emphasis on the, you know, chapter 6 numbers. But this, is Adam here? Sirhan here? Adam Sirhan? No. Everybody got their exam, right? Okay. Okay, who's taking accounting? How many people have taken accounting? Okay, here's where the accounting students and majors have it over the rest of us. I'm not trying to say you have to be a whiz at accounting to understand investing. You don't. The accountants do that stuff for us. But the more you know about accounting, the better it'll be for you as an investor, in my humble opinion. I took accounting 1 million years ago, and I got A's on both classes, and I had to take as a graduate student. And then I said, that is it. I am never doing this again unless somebody puts a big stack of $20 bills or $100 bills in front of me. I have nothing to do with this. I could do it if I don't want to. I don't want to. But that's why they have accountants. The balance sheet, the income statement, and the cash flow statement. Wait a minute. If you remember Business 121, you will remember that we only have the balance sheet and the cash flow statement. But in the Business 121 Financial Planning and Money Management class, who needs to see the spreadsheet? Anybody needs to see the spreadsheet? When we use the term cash flow statement, the accountants really use the term income statement. And when we use the term cash flow statement for an income statement, income versus expenses, they cringe. They just go, oh, the accountants just go, you idiots. But really, the cash flow statement, or sometimes called the statement of cash flows, is something very different. So let's take a look at each one in detail. The balance sheet lists our assets and then our liabilities. And then what's left over is what the company actually owns. Because the assets are everything that you own, but then there are debts to be paid. And so in the Business 121 class, we called it assets, liabilities, and then net worth. That means the same thing. What do we own? And the accountants like to write the formula this way. Assets equals liability plus equity. But most of us think of it this way. Take the assets, subtract the liabilities, and that is equal to what you have left over, your equity. And that's that book value per share. You take that equity, divide it by the number of shares, that's how much every share has of that equity. The investors and the financial planners, they separate time into short-term, intermediate-term, long-term. We do that. The accountants don't do that. They separate everything into current, which means 1 year or less, and anything above 1 year is long-term. Now, we used Caterpillar. So on the handout I just gave you, you will see a company, financial statements, the balance sheet for Caterpillar. And I grabbed it off of Yahoo, so it's very simple if you want to look at any company's balance sheet. Now, whether or not you should believe it or not is another issue altogether. Sometimes you see numbers that don't make any sense whatsoever. Then if you're really interested in that company, you want to go to their website and download their annual reports, download their quarterly reports, because that's the one thing that I think you can trust is on their website. Because if they screw up, I know Yahoo screws up every once in a while, especially with bond data. Their bond data is very unreliable. But I have a tendency to think that the big companies like Caterpillar, which is one of the Dow components, you got the right data. So if you can understand this, then you've taken accounting. But it's actually pretty straightforward. We don't necessarily know what every... We don't know what necessarily every item means. I still have a hard time understanding what goodwill is. I mean, I know what it is, but it's the fact that you're a Caterpillar and you're a phenomenal company and people all around the world want your tractors and your bulldozers. It's not really anything that you can knock your hands on. But cash and cash equivalents, so they have short-term investments and they have money sitting in the bank. And that's 7341000. Is that 7,341,000? No. All numbers in thousands add three zeros. So they got $7 billion sitting in the bank. Are you with me? Okay. Short-term investments, they probably, you know, put them in the same category as there. Net receivables, accounts receivables, that's how much money is owed to them. The dealers, that's where they mostly sell to the dealers, and the dealers sell them to other people. Inventory, that's how many tractors and stuff they have. Other current assets, total current assets. Does it make sense? And then long-term investments, property, plant, and equipment, goodwill, intangible. Goodwill is another intangible asset. It just means how cool you are. And then total assets. Then you have to look at the liabilities, accounts payable, short-term, long-term debt that is coming due short-term, other current liabilities, so current liabilities. And we're going to take a look at some ratio analysis. We'll take a look at these numbers. After we get the total liabilities, assets minus liabilities gives us the stockholders' equity. Questions, thoughts, ideas? Piece of cake? All right, I don't want to go too fast. We don't have to know how to create these. We don't have to understand every single line item. Unless we have a question, then we come back to it later and we ask somebody who does understand that. Or we go to their company's website. The income statement gives us our income, sometimes called revenue, sales, the top line number. And then we start taking away all the expenses, all the cost of goods sold, how much it costs us to sell. You remember the one SG&O? Do you remember SG&A or SG&O? S-O-N-A? S-A-N-O? S-A-N-O. It goes by different names. Sales, operating, and administrative. No. Sales, S-A-N-O. Sales, administrative, and operating expenses. Sometimes it's SG&A, sales, general, and administrative expenses. And sometimes it's sales, general, and operating expenses. So that's why I threw that in there, because you'll hear the CEOs and the CFOs use these terms, and you're supposed to understand them. Remember from chapter 5? And I didn't take off if you didn't figure it out. And somebody put SEO, search engine optimization, in the online class. And so that tells us, the income statement tells us how much money we made. So we go back and take a look at the Caterpillar income statement. They brought in $55,184,000,000 in sales in 2014. But it cost them $40,391,000,000 to make those equipment that they sold. So they have a gross profit of almost $15 billion. But then here's the SG&A, S-A-N-O, all these things, and the research and development. So here's their operating income. And then there are the other expenses, earnings before taxes, interest expense, income tax expense, and the like. And then any other non-recurring or extraordinary items. And then, boom, here is the bottom line. So did you remember listening to the earnings? Top line growth, bottom line growth. Do you remember those? That's what they're talking about. Top line is how much more dollars you're going to bring in. But the bottom line is how much of it did you actually earn. Now, is that the amount they actually earned, though? Well, it depends. Because the income statement uses generally agreed upon accounting principles. But sometimes income and expenses are not always received or paid in cash. And that is why there is the cash flow statement. Nothing to do with the cash flow statement if you've taken Business 121. That's the income statement for us. But the statement of cash flows tells us what happened to the checkbook. Because many items, you don't write a check out for them, especially depreciation. Depreciation should be on here somewhere. That's the big one. Depreciation, is the, you'll see, is the one that we add back in immediately. It's the first line. So there are non-cash items, operating cash items, investment cash items, and a cash flow, financing cash flow items. So let's go take a look at Caterpillar's. Notice it starts where the income statement ends. Okay, you told me this is your bottom line. Well, now what happened to your checkbook? What's the first thing they do? Add back in the depreciation expense. Because the depreciation expense allowed them to reduce their income, which means they pay fewer taxes, but they didn't write a check out for $3,163,000,000. The money's still there. So you add it back in, and then you see what happens with their checkbook. And we said, we talked about Lucent Technologies, that they were recording record earnings, and the cash flow, the checkbook, was going down. How does that work? You know, it doesn't work well, eventually. So here's some capital expenditures. You don't get to expense those capital expenditures in the first year. You've got to depreciate them over time. And some other things, money coming in from, there's where they paid their dividends. See, this is the one number. You'll hear people say, dividends don't lie. You hear me say it too, right? This is the one number that you can trust. Why? Because they wrote you a check, right? They don't write a check anymore. It's electronically put into your account. But you know that they paid those dividends because you got some if you're a shareholder. Make sense? Okay, so we don't have to learn how to do these. All we have to do is trust the numbers. And you have to be careful, because sometimes you look at it and you go, that can't be right. And you go to the website and go, okay, Yahoo screwed up. But it's all reported to this one, I forget what Edgar stands for, but every publicly traded company is required. Now, many on the pink sheets and the bulletin boards, they don't do it. And you'll see it. You'll see when you go to Yahoo, you'll see it's not empty. It's grayed out because they haven't reported. Or sometimes they're foreign companies and they do it somehow differently. 10K every year, and then quarterly 10Q. Regulation FD. This is kind of old information now. But before the internet, companies would be able to have meetings with analysts on Wall Street. Everybody's concentrated in New York. And the company would talk about how they expect things to be next quarter or next year. And then they'd finally get around to filing their quarterly statements and their annual statements. Well, the Securities and Exchange Commission said, look, no more. No more of this analysts getting data before anybody else. That's why there is now an earnings call. Every company schedules an earnings call, and that's what I ask you to do. And so when that earnings call happens at whatever time, it's usually right before the market or after the market closes, everybody gets to see the statements. They all go out on the internet at the same time, and then you get to listen to the CFO and the CEO, Chief Financial Officer, Chief Executive Officer, discuss the quarter. There are countless other sources. We like ValueLine. And I've heard many investors opine, you like that word, that nowadays there's simply too much information. And there's a great writer by the name of Nick Murray. You probably won't read his books because they're mostly, unless you become a stockbroker or a life insurance agent, they're mostly geared toward the sales end of it. But he had the great saying, wisdom sold separately. Isn't that a great thing? But yeah, there's so much information. And you listen to the talking heads on television or maybe on the internet, and you think, you guys, when am I going to get the wisdom? Oh, no, you got to pay for that. So now, what are we going to do with these things? We're going to first learn about some financial ratio analysis, because a ratio analysis is the study of relationships between financial statement accounts. We've already done a little bit of this. We're going to get back to it. In fact, the first ones will be reviewed, so I'm going to try to run through these as quickly as possible. And what we need to understand when we do ratio analysis is that there is no one ratio that can accurately sum up the overall general state of a company. Each ratio must be considered in the context of all the information that we've gathered. I like to think of like a stew or a soup. I don't know if that's a good analogy. You decide. Plus, you must consider any ratio in the context of the industry that the company exists within. You have to look at their competitors. You can't just look at that one company. You can't just say, this company has a PE of that, and that's why I'm going to buy them, or that's why I'm going to sell them. No, we have to look at everything and look at their competitors and look at the industry and look at the market as a whole. So these are called the common stock ratios or the market ratios. And if you look at where's the assignment sheet? Here it is. Here's the assignment sheet. I didn't pass that out. If you look on the assignment sheet, which I'm going to pass out right now, you'll see that the first group are called the common stock ratios or market ratios. And these are all reviewed. So as I said, I would like to go through these very quickly. If I'm going through them too quickly, you just raise your hand and slow me down, and I will slow down. These ratios use data from the balance sheet, the income statement, and what you'll notice on the assignment sheet is I ask you to look up at least 12 of these. I mean, I shouldn't say look up. I want you to find at least 12 of these. Do you need more?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Okay, who's got more back there? Okay, here we go. the first six or so, seven, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, you just, all you got to do is look them up, all right? So that's why I say get two from each, because I want you to do a little bit of computations. Do a little bit of computation. But these first should look pretty familiar, right? Price to earnings ratio, dividend yield, dividend payout ratio. Hey, man, we already did this. We already did it. Yeah, so let's go through this fairly quickly. All right, price to earnings ratio. By now, you should, you know, if not, that's okay, but hopefully by sooner or later, you should be getting a pretty good feel for what the PE is telling us. The higher the PE, the more investors are excited about the prospects for that company, and likewise, the more risk involved. But that doesn't mean you should just out of hand ignore a company with a PE. Is that what I'm telling you to do? With a high PE? Where are you going? Oh, okay. I'm just going to leave. Yeah, that doesn't mean you should. That doesn't mean you should ignore a company with a high PE. You've got to do more research, and it is by far the most popular stock market statistic. Historically, PE ratios were in the 5 to 12 range for mature companies, 14 to 20 range for growing companies. Greater than 20 was unusual. Today, it is commonplace. The PE ratio also tells you how long it will take in years, assuming no changes in earnings, for the company to earn back its price. And some people say, well, why do I have to know that? It's not important, but it's just something to think about. If it's a PE of 3 and nothing changes, and it's always changing all the time, it will earn back its price in 3 years. If it's a PE of 20 years, 100 years. So here are some companies, 6 different companies. And do you know all these companies? Chevron, Google, J.P. Morgan, Merck, Drug Company, General Mills, Cheerios, Amgen. It's a big biogenetics company. It's one of the big ones. You know, they've already become huge. But it's a drug company. But it does buy. Not only that, they make a lot of tests, like Abbott. They make a lot of the test kits for certain medical devices. So you look at the PEs and you go, why does Chevron have 10? That's an energy company. And Google, well, we expect that to have a higher PE, right? But Merck, a drug company, only has 14. And a bank only has 11 banks. And then that's pretty high for a food company, don't you think? Well, we expect a biotech company. Well, what we have to do is we have to look at their competitors, right? We can't just look at Chevron in a bubble by itself. You got to look at Exxon, ConocoPhillips, Shell, BP. And what we find is that 4 out of these 5, well, that makes sense, right? Chevron's got a 10.25, 11, almost 13. What? What's going on with BP? What does that tell you? Maybe something worse. Maybe what happened is the earnings fell down and the price is still up there. And Peter Lynch calls it the Wile E. Coyote effect. You know, the coyote runs off the cliff and then doesn't realize that there's nothing going on. So what it means is that we've got to do more research. It doesn't necessarily mean we shouldn't buy BP. It doesn't mean we should buy PB. BP. BP. Thank you, BP. You guys, you've never seen a BP station, unless you've been on the West Coast and East Coast. Has anybody seen a BP station? Okay, here they're ARCO. On the East Coast, they're BP. And so there's a joke on the East Coast. Why was the bee flying with her legs crossed? She was looking for a BP station. But you see, Californians don't understand that joke, because we don't have BP stations. They own ARCO. Okay, so it means we need to do more research. It means it's like a little red flag waving. Wait a minute, something isn't right. Something, you got to do more. You have to understand why this is happening. Does that make sense? Okay, let's take a look at the banks. J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank. Okay, look, they're very similar. Why Citigroup 24?
Because they were involved in
the I don't know. We've got to do more research. Does it make sense? It's like a little flag waving in the air. Go figure out why. It doesn't mean we should buy it. It doesn't mean we should. Here, look at the drug companies. They're all over the map, right? And then Bristol Myers. What's going on here? And then this is not a good sign. When you start seeing food companies with very high PEs, you're going, okay, the market's probably going to in for a tumble. I don't know what's going to happen, but I've just got to get yourself prepared when you start seeing this. And how about these guys? Look at Yahoo. What do you think about Yahoo? I don't even know what to think about Yahoo. They keep destroying their websites, one after another. They keep making... Does anybody still use Yahoo Mail? You do? My condolences. My sincerest condolences. I finally got my wife to change the Gmail because it was just so horrible. And yet, they're still around, but the PE is very low, so I don't know what investors think about that. And then the drug, the biotech companies. Does that mean we shouldn't buy it?
No.
Does it mean we should? No, it means we got to figure out why the hell people are willing to pay a price this high, the PE is so high, and maybe even, who knows? Aluminum, by the way, is yet another one of those stocks that I used to be suckers for. I don't touch anymore with a 10-foot pole.
When you want to do the research, do you go to the report thing?
Yeah, you got to get the company annual report. Look at the quarterly reports. Do your chapter 6, formulas and the like. Look at the prospects for growth. Look at the competitors. And then throw it all away and ask yourselves, do you really want to own Chevron? Do I really want to own General Mills? Yes?
Yeah. I mean, doesn't it mean when it takes 20 years to earn back the price that they're in debt?
No, that's not necessarily. All it's saying is that if nothing else changed, not that it means anything, because it doesn't mean they're going to pay dividends, but... The fact that the PE is 20 means every year, if they just continue to earn what they earn right now and the price didn't change and the area didn't change, which we know is going to happen anyway, they would earn back their price in 20 years. That's all it means. Doesn't necessarily mean they're going to pay it out in dividends. But if you have a company that has a PE of 5 or 6 and it's paying healthy dividends and they're making something that's been made for 100 years like corks, or bleach, that's a pretty darn good sign that that company is going to be around and they can afford to pay those dividends out to the shareholders. They can continue, because if some companies, for example, GE in the mid 2000s, they were losing money like crazy, but they were still paying that dividend. And people were saying, "Well, I don't care. I'm still getting that great, a very, very healthy dividend." But that couldn't last forever because they can't. If eventually, unless you have infinite amount of money, you can't continue to pay dividends and without earning it. Does that make any sense? I'm not sure if I'm answering your question. Yes?
Can you think about the PE for the food?
This, to me, is yet another piece of evidence that stocks are richly valued. And I have to prepare myself because it ain't fun to lose a lot of money. But it's going to happen. You just don't know when. And it could continue for quite some time. You go back and look at 1996, and people thought that stocks were overvalued in 1996. And then in 97, 98, 99, they just continued to go up and up. The market went in two directions, up and way up. Okay? And so the year 2000, the planes didn't fall out of the sky, the ATM machine still worked, the Y2K problem didn't destroy us. Everybody was jovial and happy. It's the new century, new technologies, blue skies, productivity gains. You're not going to go to the grocery store anymore. The web van will bring you your food. You'll shop online. Malls will all go out of business. Supermarkets will go out of business. And then 3 months later was the peak, March of 2000, and then it dropped 50% over the next 2.5 years. So I know it's coming. We know it's coming, right? Have I convinced you that there are going to be downturns? That you're not going to get rich quickly. It's going to take time. And there's going to be
time. Probably for Biden, it's a good time to wait
and stop. Say that again loudly.
I said for buyers, first-time buyers, it's good because you can wait till that happens to buy like a lot.
Okay. You're espousing the theory, the strategy that a contrarian would espouse. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
And that I agree with you 100%. The problem is, after 3 years of 20, 25, 10, 25%, you are human, I am human, we will turn around and say, okay, finally throw in the towel. And then that's when the market will drop 30, 40%. It's very difficult to be a contrarian. That's why I like, and that's what I've done over the last, you know, almost 30 years, every month out of my paycheck, my 403B contribution, out of our checking account, my wife and my Roth IRAs, when things have fallen, I've put more money in. The money I put into stocks I've played with, I did okay, actually pretty well, as long as I followed the, you know, Benjamin Graham stuff that we did in Chapter 6. And when I bought Illumina's, it wasn't Illumina, it was Alliance Pharmaceutical, but it was such a good company. And I screwed up. So you have to decide how you're going to do it. Remembering that if you keep putting $50, $100 a month away, when the market tanks, that's when you'll be buying low. Right? So now you're buying high, and you're buying fewer shares. And when the market tanks, you're going to put $100 or $50 away. And I just think it's an easier strategy for most of us humans. But if you're Warren Buffett, or if you're Leonard Kaplan, if you remember the... that's the next chapter. I'm sorry, next chapter. We'll talk about contrarians in the next chapter. Then, yes, you wait, you sit on your hands, and you're willing to let people just go crazy until the market crashes, and then you swoop in and buy $5 billion worth of GE, $5 billion worth of Goldman Sachs, and do really well. But that's Warren Buffett. Yeah. Am I answering your questions? I don't know if I'm answering. All right, let's continue. How can we account for the wide P.E. disparity between different industries and different companies within industries? Again, it is the expectation of future earnings and dividend growth by investors. It's all about... Question, George? You having a problem? Just wanted to see the...
Yeah.
You need to get out of here?
No.
Okay. That's okay. No problem. It is the expectation of future earnings, future dividend growth. And this is from A Random Walk Down Wall Street, one of those books that you eventually should read. This is a guy named Jack Dreyfus. Now, you might have heard of Dreyfus Funds. They're one of the largest fund companies. They're actually owned by the Bank of New York now, the nation's oldest bank that you've never heard of. Take a nice little company that has been making shoelaces for 40 years, and sells at a respectable 6x earnings ratio, 6 PE. Change the name from Silicon Incorporated, from Shoelaces Incorporated, to Electronics and Silicon Firth Burners. In today's market, meaning the 1960s, the words electronics and silicon are worth 15x earnings. However, the real play comes from the word Firth Burner, which nobody understands. A word that no one understands entitles you to double your entire score. Therefore, we have 6x earnings for the shoelace business, 15x earnings for the electronics and silicon, or a total of 21x earnings. Multiply this by 2 for Firth Burners, and we now have a score of 42x earnings for the new company. You see, he's joking, right? But he's not. He's not. In the 1960s, silicon and electronics, that was the integrated chip, was created in 1959. I don't know if you guys knew that. But the transistor was created in 1949. 10 years later, the integrated circuit, which is a bunch of transistors on a piece of silicon, was created. And that's what made computers more easily available. Before, they were, they used vacuum tubes and they took up entire rooms. They didn't have as much computing as your watch. But today, you replace Firth Burners with nanotechnology or 3D printing, right, that people don't understand. And you replace electronics and silicon with social networking in China, which is exciting. Well, now people are a little worried about China. But you understand? The technology changes, but the feeling that people don't. They want to get in on the next big thing, so they're willing to build it up. Nanotechnology started to get into the lexicon about 7-8 years ago. And there's a company based in San Diego called Nanotech. And after several reports in the media about nanotechnology came out, their stock started to rise. And they were, all of a sudden the volume started to pick up. And the company didn't have any new news. And they, you know, reporters would ask them, is anything going on? No, we're basically doing the same thing we've always been doing. And they attributed it, not that we don't know, because we can't ask each individual investor, they attributed it to these people hearing about nanotechnology and going, okay, I better buy a company that has something to do with nanotechnology. Oh, this company is called Nanotech. I'll buy it. Without even knowing what the company does. What is nanotechnology, by the way? Really small things. Really small things. And it's already revolutionized one part of you that you may not even know. Most of you now, maybe not, maybe still, some of you still use cotton, but now your clothes are using nanotechnology fibers, and that's why the wine just sort of, you drop wine on your clothes. Have you got any clothes like that? Well, I do. And I spill a lot. And if you spill something, the wine just goes, whoop, just falls right off, because, yes.
So you mean like wetproof?
Well, it doesn't sink in. It doesn't sink in. It's got these little, tiny little fibers that sort of protect it from having stuff sink into the clothing, so it just falls right off. It's not Scotchgard. It's the fibers. It's actually the fiber that they use to make the clothing is nanotechnology. I don't understand it. I mean, how do you make something that small you can't even see? But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I teach. Okay. Anyway, price to earnings to growth, the PEG ratio. Huh? This one you don't see too often. Actually, it's in this key statistics in Yahoo. But all this is doing is comparing the P-E ratio to the rate of growth. You see, traditionally, the P-E ratio should have equaled the growth rate. That was desirable. And so if you put the stock's P-E ratio over the growth rate and they're equal to 1, that means they're equal. If the ratio is equal to 1, if it's 20 P.E. over 20% growth rate, 7 P.E. over 7% growth rate, then the PEG ratio would be 1, excuse me. If it were greater than 1, it meant that this number was bigger than this number. And if it was less than 1, it would mean that this number was smaller than this number. Make sense? You don't hear too many people talk about that often. And so I'm not going to ask you that much about it, and just that you can identify it. And you will notice on the sheet of paper I gave you, are all the ratios, right? There they all are, defined. All right, the dividends per share. We've already discussed this. How much dividends each share of stock will receive? That you don't have to calculate that. They announce it. Dividends became taboo during the 1990s. How are we doing over time? Since the 2000 to 2002 bear market, investors have changed their minds about dividends. Dividends can be discussed in polite company again. Yes? Do you like dividends?
Yeah.
I hope. See, I tell you my bias up front, right? At the same time, I definitely want to brainwash you. So I'll tell you, I'm trying to brainwash you. Dividend yield. Is dividend yield important? Yes, because it allows us to compare a company to a savings account or to a bond. If we have a company that's paying us 4 to 6%, that's a very rich dividend these years. But that used to be normal. The S&P is, no, it's just under. It's gone under. Yeah, I know, this is old. I must not have, I thought I fixed this. It's under 2%, 10-year bond is under 2%, and savings accounts are yielding far less than 1%. Some stocks are paying much more, while growth stocks are paying no dividend. So this is a little old. The S&P 500 is yielding a little under 2%, and what's the 10-year Treasury bond? Let's go look. It went up and then it went down. It's been kind of volatile. So let's go to Yahoo. Where's Yahoo Finance? See, they used to tell you. They don't tell you anymore. Why don't they tell you anymore? Let's go to MarketWatch. MarketWatch. I only use Yahoo to go to individual stocks. Here's rates. Come on, sweetheart. Oh, jeez. I hate computers. I used to love computers, but now I hate them. Rates. Here it is. 1.64%. Wow. It's not done very well. So the 10-year, this is what we're going to get the bonds in a few weeks. People are buying bonds, 10-year Treasury bonds, paying 1.656%. You can buy a stock that's paying you a whole lot better than that. What's the difference? Is the United States government going to be paying that money for the next 10 years? Yeah, the United States government is not going to default on their debts. I don't care what any Republicans in Congress say. It's not going to happen, and you're going to get your money back. If you buy Procter & Gamble paying whatever it's paying, 3%, let's look at 3%. Let's think of Procter & Gamble's paying, like the Yahoo website. Untimely as it may be, value line. Is Procter & Gamble going to continue to pay us 3%? Think so. Maybe. But is it guaranteed? Could the company go out of business? It's not likely, but yeah. So you see the difference? You see the difference? Okay. I think bonds. I am definitely not excited about bonds. The dividend payout ratio, we computed that. It's pretty simple. You take the dividends per share, the earnings per share. More mature companies often pay out almost all of their earnings in the form of dividends. Growing companies retain the earnings. You accountants, what's it called? Retained earnings. Isn't it nice? Usually some really ridiculous number name. There it is. So growing companies need those earnings to support the growth of the company. The book value per share, do we have to calculate that? No, we go under Key Statistics in Yahoo. Common stockholders' equity divided by number of shares. Book value per share tells an investor how much assets are behind each share of stock. In other words, if all the assets of the company were liquidated, how much would be left over after you paid the debts? It is common for the actual market price of a share to be way above the book value. And you saw that in Chapter 5. Stock might be selling for $45. The book value is $15. It is common for the market price to be far above the book value. We're almost done. We're almost done. Price to book value per share is the same thing as price to earnings. It's just showing us how much more, normally it's more than one, is the market price over the book value per share. Given that the book value per share is often less than the market price, it tells an investor how far above the book value the market price. If they were equal, it would be one. If they go below one, then it's a real danger because the company could be liquidated. Corporate raiders can come in and liquidate it. And then price the cash flow per share. We discussed this already. We used the model instead of price to earnings. We look at price to cash flow because cash flow is often a better indicator of how the company's doing. We take out we put back in the depreciation and the like. And then the last one, price to sales, again, review. So how do you feel?
The cash value is the money that they have available.
Cash flow is actually how much cash is coming through the door. Earnings are an accounting entity that we tell the IRS, this is how much we earned, and so we have to... Right. Cash flow says, hey, this is how much our checkbook went up or went down. I got money in my pocket. Okay, good. Makes sense? So that's a lot of review, but I want you to study. I mean, I'm serious. When you take the Series 7, many of you will take the Series 7, you're going to take these exams over and over and over again. They give you these practice exams, and that's yours, and you take them over and over and over again. So on Thursday, we will finish up, and we'll actually do some calculations, so do bring your calculators. Thursday, we'll finish up this chapter. We should get through everything, and then we will start the silliness about stocks. Do excellent study every day, folks, and I'll see you on Thursday. Okay, let me get this thing off, turn this off.